We are past the 7:30, so welcome all to the Q&A session for the Auto PCs group. If you are here as a guest, welcome. If you want to join the group, I've pasted in a link into the chat, and feel free to click on that, and you'll be able to join our happy little band for $20 a year. We are recording the audio. Actually, we're not yet. Yes, we are recording the audio, and right now I'm going to mute all. And everybody will have the ability to unmute themselves. Feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question, or you can use the chat window. Please remute yourself afterwards to keep the background noise to a minimum. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And I just remind everybody that we try to leave the last 10 minutes free for questions, so if you have any questions, keep them till then, or put something in the chat, and we'll be monitoring that as we go along. And first up, we have a question that Chris is going to deal with.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. So we had a question come in from Molly Woden asking about printers and moving to Windows 11. So she said she had heard that one possible downside of Windows 11 is that older, and she quoted 5 years or older as being older, printers may not work. Do you know if that's true? And that's the reason why she hasn't updated to Windows 11. Next. So the printer in question here was a Brother HL2270DW. I looked it up. It was first manufactured over 11 years ago, so it certainly qualifies that older category. And her unit, you can look up the serial numbers and that, and you can get a month and year that it was actually manufactured. And it was actually manufactured in July of 2013. So it is quite an old printer. Next. So I think it's worth actually stepping back a little bit here and talking about more general terms about hardware and moving to new versions of Windows. So if we look back to the fundamentals, all hardware devices in any operating system require a driver to work. And really a driver is just software that lets the operating system talk with a piece of hardware, whether that's a printer or a mouse or a screen or a webcam or any hardware device at all. Next. So all operating systems do come with a whole bunch of drivers. So what they want to do is have most hardware handled right out of the box so that when you install the operating system, most of your hardware should just work without any question. And this includes common things like mice, keyboards, disk drives, monitors, webcams, and so forth. Next. Now, there are special drivers often that can expose additional features in that piece of hardware that a generic driver will not enable. So it'll work just by plugging it in by using one of the generic drivers that are built into the operating system, in this case Windows, but it will work better or have more features available if you use a special driver for that particular piece of hardware. Mice and keyboards are somewhat common, and Logitech is really famous for this. You can get a generic driver that'll work, but if you install a Logitech driver, you'll get all kinds of extra things like smooth scrolling and being able to customize the buttons and things like that. Next. So the final category is some hardware that it will require specialized drivers from the manufacturer to work at all. And so there will not be a driver in the box when you install the operating system, and you will have to install a specialized driver that comes from the manufacturer. Now, it may actually be bundled with the operating system. Okay, so if the company, I guess, is big enough or has enough clout with Microsoft, they may be able to get Microsoft to bundle that in with the operating system. But even if you have it bundled in with the operating system, very often you can get updated drivers from the manufacturer's website, which will fix bugs or address security issues or things like that. Printers and display adapters often really require specific drivers for that particular model and make of a piece of hardware. Next. So a rule of thumb that I go by And the dates on this can vary a little bit, but if your hardware device, if it came out when the operating system was released or when it is the current version of the operating system, then for sure a driver is going to be available. There's no manufacturer who is going to come out with a new printer or whatever hardware device that doesn't work with the current version of Windows. So you can be guaranteed that there will be at least a basic driver that will allow it to function. Next. If it came out 5 years before your operating system was released, so say Windows 11 came out a little over a year ago, and so if you had a piece of hardware that was came out on the market 6 years ago, then almost certainly there will be a driver available. Now, it might not be in the box because it didn't exist when the operating system was first released, but the manufacturer is looking at this and saying, well, we just sold somebody a printer or a keyboard or whatever last year. We're not going to go and tell them that, okay, you can't have it work with the latest version of the operating system. They will write a driver and make it available to their customers. Next. If you have some piece of hardware that came out more than 5 years before whatever operating system you're trying to get this to work under was released, then a driver may be available. And that's really, as it gets older and older, the manufacturer is less likely to want to go to the trouble of writing a driver to allow it to work. They feel a little bit more justified in telling you that, well, no, you're just going to have to buy a newer piece of hardware from us, of course. We would prefer that. But they're just going to say, at some point, no, we didn't write a driver for this, for that particular operating system. Next. So the first thing you can do is check with the manufacturer. And so you could manually find the website just by doing a Google search. So I Googled for Brother HL2270DW and then add the word drivers. Okay, so I'm looking for the manufacturer, the model, and then the word drivers. And I have a caution here that you should avoid third-party sites. This is not a hard and fast rule, but if you can get it directly from the manufacturer, you're better off. Next. So you can see on the first one, the URL is actually to support.brother.com. So that's actually the Brother website. And so I trust it to have, you know, the drivers available. Next. And then the next link down also was to a page on the Brother website. So that'd be okay. Next. This one came from printerdrivers.com. So it's not Brother that is running that website. They are probably just making available the actual Brother drivers. But I don't know. I don't know who this company is or anything like that. And I would suspect that anything that is available on that website is also available directly from Brother. So I would end up going directly to Brother in order to get it. Next. So the other thing you can do is just go to the manufacturer's website. So in this case, it's a Brother printer. So I just went to brother.ca. And you can see in the top menu bar on the website, they have one that says support and service. So that sounds likely. And sure enough, on that dropdown, download drivers and guides. So I click on that. And then this is very typical of most manufacturers. It'll look similar to this. So I get to a page and there's a product search. So I click on that. And then I type in, you know, what is the model name? So in this, I put in the HL, whatever, the actual model of the printer, and click on search. And it comes up with a list of things that I can get from the website. So I can get downloads, I can get FAQs and troubleshooting, I can get manuals and things like that. So, you know, obviously in this one here, I want to get a driver, so I click on the downloads link. And lo and behold, I finally get to the point where I can actually select a driver. Now this is pretty impressive what they actually have available. So there are radio buttons across the top. I can select for drivers for Windows, the Mac OS, Linux, or mobile, and mobile really means iOS, Apple, iPhone, iPads, things like that, or Android devices. So I want Windows, and so I look down at what I have available on Windows, and they actually have drivers from Windows XP, which sort of makes sense because when that first printer first came out, XP was actually current. So they have it from XP, and they do go right to Windows 11. So this is great. I know that I'm going to be able to get this printer working in Windows 11. Next. And so I go to, I clicked on the OK and when I selected Windows 11, and then it comes up with what is available for Windows 11 for this particular printer. I can get drivers and utilities, and this is their recommended download, or I can get next. I just the driver. If I don't want all of their extra utilities and things like that, I can get just the driver that'll allow the printer to actually function. And then next, there are just the utilities. So I can go in and I can be selective. I recommend most people just actually get the drivers and utilities. That'll give you all of the extras that will allow you to do maybe scanning from the printer, or it might have, you know, who knows what these extra utilities are going to be. But I usually just pick up everything. Next. And then you download and install them once you have the operating system you want. So in this case here, it's a driver for Windows 11. It may be actually the identical driver to the Windows 10 version. I don't know, but it may not function in Windows 10. So it might be very specific to Windows 11. So I wait until the upgrade is actually done. You can do the download and then just wait to install it until after you've upgraded to Windows 11, then run the install program. Even if the printer seems to work, I would go ahead and run it because it's going to be the latest version of the driver. There may be some things that are enhancements in Windows 11, and so that's the route that I would end up going on that. So next. So the other thing is, what about the reverse? So say you're using an older version of the operating system. It's old that it actually uses hieroglyphics rather than the Latin alphabet. So it's a really old version of the operating system that you've got, and you want to buy a brand new printer. And so what you want to know is, will this run in my operating system that uses hieroglyphics? So the first thing you do is check the specifications or the side of the box for the system requirements. They typically will have on it what the operating system requirements are. Now, even if they don't list your hieroglyphic-based operating system, go to the manufacturer's website, because they may not list it on the box. But if you get to the manufacturer's website, they may actually have drivers available for your particular version of the operating system. And so before you buy it, you can actually verify that it is actually going to work on your operating system. And that's what I would recommend that people do on that. And so I think that from a generic point of view, you could run that from just about any piece of hardware that you're wondering whether you're going to be able to get working in Windows 11 or not, or a new version of the operating system. If you look through that process, I think you can map it into just about any piece of hardware. And that's it.
Thanks, Chris. Tom made a note that even some old devices will work with drivers from the same company, even if the model isn't included.
Yeah, that's true. The trouble comes trying to validate it. So if you're stuck and you've gone and you've done the upgrade to the latest version of the operating system and your hardware is not working or whatever, and you can just go and try different drivers to see if you can get it working. So pick up something that looks like it's as close as possible to it, things like that. It's always possible. Always contacting the actual manufacturer as well and say, you know, what your particular situation is, and asking for recommendations might help as well. But, yeah, the manufacturers tend to have these classes of drivers that work with a broad range of their particular hardware. And so it will, when it's working, it will look to see what device am I actually talking to, and it will adjust itself to that particular device. So, yeah, good advice there for sure.
And Stuart notes that he's using a Pantom laser printer with Windows 11. And it has one error message that he has to clear after every print job. For some reason, it wants flash. Clearing that print message, everything works. So that's another thing you can do, I guess, just ignore the one.
Yeah. I guess if it's functioning, yeah, that's right.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. Okay, so moving along. Sorry, somebody's trying to cut in. They're not trying to cut in. Okay, next on the agenda, we have Lawrence, who's going to continue with his Sweet Home 3D, and I believe he's going to share his screen.
I am indeed. Sorry, Alan. I was just going to say that the Stu's example is probably due to the program that provides the message being built on one type of interface and then drivers working on another site type of programming interface. So, yeah. But in the end, the printer works after you hit ignore. So that's all is good. All right. So how can we move on from the exciting world of printers? Well, of course, we're going to get into Sweet Home 3D. And we're going to get into what is probably something that a lot of us will have trouble with. And rightfully so. And this is, again, we're going to continue talking about walls. And in this particular session, we're going to talk about why wall accuracy matters. Once again, I'd like to thank John for preparing the content for this video. I'm just the guy that gets to speak about it and sort of pretty things up. So without further ado, if you remember from the last time we presented, we had both a actual handwritten sketch. Remember when I said to you how important the handwritten sketch is? Well, John is going to prove the point, but he also wanted to emphasize one of the features that Sweet Home 3D has. And that is to take your sketch and actually build a basic layout from that sketch. So, that's great. We've done that. We're starting to find that the math doesn't always work. So where is that happening? Well, we have the fact that the room was measured at 124 inches. And, that works out to 10 feet, 4 inches. Sorry, folks, I keep on moving my mouse around. Yet, the Sweet Home 3D, it's coming out as 10 feet, 2 inches. There's a number of reasons, there's the human factor, but there's also the point that, we didn't take account purposely of the wall thickness. And, Sweet Home 3D, it measures to the center of the wall where, us humans, we can't put our hands through walls and so forth. We're measuring from inside surface to inside surface. And there's probably other situations going on as well. So understanding that, we can make corrections after the fact. And that's the beauty of Sweet Home 3D, is that we go in and we start with double-clicking on the wall. And we bring up the printer dialog properties. Sorry, printer. Geez. Bring up the properties dialog where we can actually change the thickness, as you can see here. So we also can change the length, as what's being done here. Now, as mentioned, we're dealing with an early 1960s walls. We're going to assume that construction is a 2x4 studs. And we're going to allow for half an inch of drywall. We're going to allow for half an inch of plywood. And, take into consideration the aluminum siding. So we got the length set at 26 and a half feet. So we're going to make the corrections for the right-hand wall. And after that, we're going to do that for the remaining walls. Now, as we've done that, you'll note here that, we no longer have a square wall. And then our interior dimensions are getting out of whack. We note that we're dealing with 22 and a half feet, but it's still not right because we haven't accounted for the wall thickness. Again, reminder, Sweet Home 3D, measured from the middle of the adjoining wall to the middle of the next. So we have to add the width to the wall of the wall to the length so as to get the correct interior dimension. The rectangle is skewed because the extra length is added to the training end of the wall. And we drew it in a clockwise direction. And now we're getting into more issues because after we make further corrections, the skewing is becoming more pronounced. And, you know, we're running into other issues that the walls no longer connect in the upper left-hand corner. So here we go. We're going to show this video, and we're going to have John walk. Well, I'm going to talk it through, but John is going to show you how we're going to fix this. And with that, just give it a moment here. And here we go. So we're going to make a single click at the end of the wall and make it snap to a position at the start so it's 90 degrees. Thus, the importance of knowing the beginning and ending of a wall. So we're going to do that. And then at the second intersection, as the cursor approaches that intersection, it changes to a plus sign inside the broken square. This is where a single click corrects the angle of the wall starting point. And now we're getting into the match the top and bottom wall lengths by setting the dialog box, making small adjustments to the wall position, and by highlighting a wall and moving it with the arrow keys. Next, we are going to zoom in. And with the start and end points, we're going to make slight adjustments so to make them even. I know we should have some music and going on with this, but, and then we're making further adjustments here to our ruler. And as it continues to make adjustments, and there we, I got ahead of myself. And there we are. Okay, so that's how we've adjusted, and as you can see, we're back to having everything at right angles. So with that said, so the conclusion is that the next time we are going to start fixing the interior walls. As you can see here, we've done the adjustments to the exterior walls, and now we find that our interior walls are out of place. So stay tuned. In a couple weeks' time, we'll be working on the interior walls. Have any questions, or if you're interested in providing further feedback, you know how to get a hold of me at lawrence@opcug.ca. Thank you.
Tom is asking if you can show the angle in degrees.
We can show the angles.
I think he means the right angle in the corner of the walls.
I would guess it would only be important if you're not at 90 degrees, if you do have a skewed wall or something like that.
I think there is an area where you can see the degrees. It's a good point. I mean, they discuss about the fact of having angle walls and so forth. It's not something I've done yet, but I do know you can do it. So I would have to say, yes, you can show it. I'm just not sure how it would display.
It might be useful in some circumstances. People do make hexagonal houses.
Well, I have a basement wall that I have to figure out the angle to. And anyways, I'm not sure how I'm going to go about it, but I'm going to do it at some point. So
I guess it'll be protracted.
Ta-da.
Thanks a lot, okay, Lawrence.
Thanks very much, Lawrence. And next up, we have a computer basics item from Linda.
Okay, thanks, Alan. So I noticed when Lawrence was making a presentation that he had some folders on his Chrome bookmark bar, and I wanted something for myself, and I didn't know how to do it. So this share is about that, how to organize your bookmark bar using folders. So it just gives you more space to see other icons on your main bar since it replaces some of the individual folders. So this is what my Chrome tabs look like with no folders. So you see it's, you know, a long, long list. And then I've got a drop down overflow list. Can you hit, I'll just say next, Alan, and it'll do the builds on this. Thank you. So those are the tabs, and next, and then the overflow. So that's what I was trying to tidy up a bit. So next. So anywhere in the Chrome browser, you can right-click and go to Bookmark Manager, next, and then click on Bookmark Bar. So you can see I had some folders in my other bookmarks. I just never dawned on me I could have them on the Bookmark Bar. So click on the Bookmark Bar and next, and then the three dots in the corner and add a new folder. Next. So this folder I created, I called it Photography, next. And it inserted it under as a subfolder under the bookmarks bar. Next. And of course, it just added it to the list of overflow items that I already had. So that's fine. Now there's a little folder called Photography. Next. And then I just click and drag it up to the main bar. So now I've got that on my main Chrome browser. Next. And I dragged in three websites that were related to photography. Next. And so I did that for a few things, my word games, my COVID, and I collapsed a total of 9 different bookmarks in my overflow. So it's looking much nicer and much more like Lawrence's. So that's a good thing. I think that's it. Thank you.
Thanks, Linda.
Yeah, Tom mentions that he deletes the text for a bookmark and just uses the icon. And that's a good point, is that you can shorten up or eliminate, but at least shorten a lot of the titles that they put onto things so they don't take up as much room. But ultimately, yeah, you do get down to that point where you do want to collapse a bunch of them onto, and this is a really good way to consolidate them onto a folder so that by topic, you just click once on the topic and you get the icons for that.
It doesn't save you any clicks, but it is nicely organized. And that's a good idea that Tom suggested, but I do get kind of confused on some of the icons. A lot of them are blue, so but for sure, like the Google Maps or something like that, I don't need to be told it's Google Maps, so that's a good idea.
So Martin asks, can you move an existing folder in your other folders into the bookmarks bar, or do you have to create an all-new folder?
I would presume you could click and drag it. I haven't tried it, but I would presume you could.
Yeah, you can, for sure.
Yeah, and Micheline had noted that she likes an HTML web page, a local file with all of the frequent links. And of course, if you have lots of links, you need subpages that you link to from the main page. So it's kind of like the bookmarks idea, but a different way of doing it, I guess. And you also have to know HTML. Okay, thanks very much, Linda. That was great. So moving along, we have a question, which again, Chris is going to answer.
Yeah, so this came in from Bob Walker, and he had a problem with drive letters all of a sudden getting messed up on external storage devices. So his situation was he had a flash drive that was permanently plugged into his laptop, one of the little mini ones that barely sticks out of the computer, and it was set up as drive D. And it contained active files, and so he had quick access lists, jump lists, other things like that that were reflected that these were documents that were actually on drive D. Next. So he needed to replace the flash drive because it was getting a little bit flaky, so he plugged in a replacement flash drive. D was already used, so the replacement drive came up as drive E, and then he copied all the files from drive D, the old flash drive, onto E, the new flash drive, and then got rid of the old flash drive. Next. He also had a 4 terabyte spinning hard drive that he periodically plugged in to do backups. And it used to be on drive E, and now all of a sudden it was coming up on F because D and E were essentially used. So it was coming up on F. So next. So he wanted to know how to restore the former drive letters so that everything worked as it did before with the old drives. Next. So if we step back on this one, the Windows default is that it uses the next available drive letter whenever you plug in a new drive. Next. So Windows tends to remember drive letter assignments, or tries to remember drive letter assignments, so that when you unplug it and plug it back in later, it tries to use the old drive letter for any given physical device that you actually have. So it actually notes what the device was by a serial number or whatever. And when you unplug it and plug it back in, it will try to use the same drive letter. Next. So all of that is a good thing, usually. So next. So the nice and orderly situation that we had to start with, you had Bob's computer. He has a laptop, but then we have a computer here with an internal hard drive C, and that drive C will never change. Next. He plugged in flash drive and Windows assigned drive letter D to it. Next. He plugged in his external hard drive to do backups, and it assigned drive letter E. Windows will try to maintain that D and E relationship on those physical devices. So then if you unplug all of the external hard drives and flash drive, and you end up with basically just your drive C again, and next, say you plug in the external hard drive, okay? Even though D is available, it knew that this had been assigned drive letter E, so it will use drive letter E again. Next. And then if you plug in that flash drive, Windows assigns drive letter D because Windows knew it was drive letter D before, so it will still maintain that relationship on that. Next. So all is good up to this point. Next. Now we get into what created the mess. So next. So you plug in the flash drive that Windows assigned to drive D. Next. You plug in the replacement flash drive, Windows assigns drive E to it, and then Bob copied all his files from D to E, and he disposed of drive D. Next. Unplug both those flash drives. Next. And plug in the replacement flash drive, Windows assigns it drive E. Even though D is available at that point in time, Windows knows that this was assigned drive E previously, and it will keep that, so there'll be a gap in the drive letters. Next. You plug in the external hard drive, Windows knows it was E. E is not available because that's taken up by the replacement flash drive. Windows goes and assigns drive letter F. Next. So the flash drive was drive D. Now the new one, the replacement one, is drive E. The external hard drive used to be E and is now drive F. So it's a big mess for any program that's expecting old drive assignments. And this goes with the jump lists of points that point to files and things like that. If you have a backup program that, in Bob's case, if it had been set up to automatically backup things to drive E, all of a sudden drive E isn't there anymore. It's drive F. So anything that is expecting those old drive assignments is going to have a problem. Next. So how do we fix this? We lock down drive letters. So the first step I would do is unplug all the external drives except the one drive you want to set a drive letter for. Next. Then you right-click on the Start button. Next. And you choose Disk Management from the pop-up menu that you get there. Next. It'll usually take about 30 seconds for it to enumerate all the drives and everything like that, but eventually you come up with a list of all of your drives or partitions that are on your computer currently at that point in time. Right-click on the drive you want to set the drive letter for. And you can use either the top pane or the bottom pane. You have to click in the specific spot that I'm pointing to. So if you're using the top pane, you have to use that left column. Right-click on the where it says, in this case, this example, My Book S. Or if you're in the using the bottom pane, you can't use the left-hand column. You have to click where the drive letter is actually specified. So My Book S. So you right-click on that, and then next. You choose from a pop-up menu, Change Drive Letters and Paths. Next. When that dialog box comes up, it'll show you the current assignment, Drive S in this case, and you click on the Change button. Next. And then you'll get a drop list that you can click on by pointing on the chevron or actually anywhere where it has the Drive S listed. You click on that. It'll open up the list of available drive letters. And then you choose, next, you choose whatever drive letter you want to assign that to. Next. And then you will, on going okaying out of all of this, you will get a warning. Some programs that rely on drive letters may not run correctly because you're changing the drive letter. Well, in actual fact, that's what you want to have happen. So you just click on yes, and it will go ahead and it'll change that drive letter. So in Bob's case, I would go in, do that with the replacement flash drive, set it back to D, and then Windows will remember that particular device from then on and try to assign drive letter D. I would then plug in the external hard drive, and then it would come up as F because that's the last thing it knew it as, and so set it back to, in this case, it'd be E, and then Windows will remember that device as drive E from then on. So just go step by step through all your devices. So some best practices that sort of come out about this. Be careful of changing drive letters on any drive that is already being used for whatever purpose, because if you have a program that expects it to be on that drive letter, it can cause problems for you. So think about it before you willy-nilly decide to change drive letter assignments. Next. I recommend that you assign very specific, unique drive letters for every external drive you ever expect to plug into this computer so that they will always come up on an expected drive letter. Next. I suggest that it's probably best to assign letters near the end of the alphabet. You know, I usually work backwards from the end of the alphabet, Z, Y, X, and so forth, because Windows assigns things from the other end of the alphabet. So if Windows assigns a letter, it's less likely to end up using or some drive letter that you've assigned to some device that is not in your computer at that particular time, which you then later on plug in, and all of a sudden you get that conflict and Windows has to move it to a new drive letter. So if you assign them from the far end of the alphabet, less likely to end up with conflicts. Next. So if you have an external drive that is going to be used on multiple computers, I do this for offsite backups. So I have a hard drive that moves from computer to computer. Once a month, I go and do a backup of all of these different computers. So I like to assign the same drive letter when it's used on every computer. So I just happen to know that my 5 terabyte portable drive, it is drive letter X. On every computer I plug it into, it's going to come up as drive X. And I just come to rely on that, and it's very predictable for me. So I do have some drives that move from one computer to another that have not retained the drive letter when they plug in, but more often than not, it seems that they do retain the drive letter correctly. I don't know what causes this to sometimes fail. Just watch for it when you plug a device in. If you need it on a specific letter, I see what it comes up as, and I will just go into the disk management and change it if I need to. Next. Now, this brings up an interesting thing. When you look at the letters that you can assign to any drive, there will always be A and B on the list of available drive letters that you can assign to it. So in the ancient world, this was assigned, these were reserved for floppy drives. And we no longer have floppy drives, but the drive letters still actually exist. Windows will never assign an external drive to A or B by itself. So you could actually safely assign an external hard drive to drive letter A or B. Next. To me, this feels a little bit like whistling past the graveyard, where you're not sure if something bad is going to happen. Personally, I would never do it, but it should work. I'm just worried that there is some program somewhere along the line that is going to decide, oh, drive A or B, well, that's a floppy drive, so it can't possibly have a gigabyte of space on it or whatever, so I'm going to refuse to use it, or something weird like that. So I don't do it, but if anybody has had great success in using A or B, all the more power to you. And if anybody has bad tales of having used A or B to assign to an external hard drive or flash drive, I'd love to hear about it. And that's all I have on that.
Actually, Chris, drive A on my system gets assigned when I plug in my external floppy drive.
Oh, that's it. That sort of makes sense, actually. Yeah. Okay.
So yeah. Tom makes a note that he uses that XYZ type deal, but he says, oddly, his DVD drive insists on coming up as drive N.
That's curious as well. I wonder if some devices or something have a way of telling Windows, and maybe they just don't want to have them moved accidentally or whatever, and so they have a way of telling Windows that, hey, assign drive letter N to it. I don't know. It should be, any drive should be assignable, so you should be able to go in and actually use disk management to assign different drive letter to it. I've never run into that, but that's an interesting curiosity. If you have something like that something refuses to be assigned anything other than that drive letter, okay, you just live with that and you move your other drive letters to something else.
That's what I did.
Yeah. Very okay. Curious.
Stay on the line, Tom, because you're next. So our next item, Tom is going to do part two of his nuts and bolts under the hood of Windows. And I believe he's going to share his screen again.
And
I shall. Yeah, it's, if I'm going to talk to everybody, then it's best to unmute. Otherwise, it would be a mute point. Okie doke. This is Under the Hood, part two. This is a SysInternals program called Auto Runs, and basically it allows you to see and control automatic startups. There are many places that have automatic startups, many places on your computer. Now, the startup folder, which many people are familiar with, there's the registry, which has a variety of entries. I'm not sure why I have Task Manager here, but it's a way of looking at startups. But services and drivers, file explorer extensions, WinLogon, and there are others. And let me get to... Where? Okay, there it is. So, what? Why do you need to look at these auto runs? What's the purpose of looking at them? Why should you bother looking at them? And there are reasons to delete or disable some auto runs. You can minimize your startup time. You can minimize your memory usage because everything that starts up kind of hangs around and uses up memory and CPU cycles. Some of those startups may be spyware or malware, and it's a good idea to get rid of that stuff. You can remove excess backgrounds processing, programs that are doing things that you don't really care about, so why bother using up parts of your CPU? And you can remove clutter. I would note one thing, that if you're going to actually make changes, then you need to run it as administrator if you want to make changes. So this is what it looks like. This is the Yotta run screen, and as you can see, there's the entry, there's a description of it, the publisher, image path, which is basically the file that has actually started executing. There's a timestamp as to when it was last updated. This is in regards to the file. And there's another column here, Virus Tovo. People may be familiar with Virus Tovo, but it's a website that checks against 70-plus engines, antivirus engines, as to whether or not a particular program might be a virus. It's not perfect. It's not 100% accurate, but it's kind of a vote on how bad a particular program is. So you can see here, Wind Patrol has a vote of 1 over 76 said it was a virus. It's not a virus. It's an old program that, alas, is obsolete, but it's the only program I know that actually looks at things that are, looks at programs that have started to be in your startup folder or other places. And Wind Patrol is the only one that gives you notice of that. And of programs like that going. So it's a valuable program to me, and I trust that it's been around for many years. This says, well, it doesn't have the year, I'm afraid. So this is what it looks like. It's a tab layout. This is looking at everything, but you can look at particular parts or areas on your operating system. Log on areas, Explorer, Internet Explorer. I know it's obsolete. Scheduled tasks, print monitors, Winsock providers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things can start up either on a timed basis or a log on basis or on some other basis. So these are things that everything captures, and it shows you here. These are registry entries. This is in this registry entry, these are run on a When the computer starts. I'm not sure what the other particular choices are, but those are various areas that have startup things. So it's a tab layout. You can look at everything or particular categories. Verified, like this, means that it's been verified by a program signature. The publisher is who it says it is. And you can also search name by a quick filter or find, which is up here with the magnifying glass as usual. So here's an example of the logons tab. And there are a variety of entries here. This is, you can see this isn't exactly the same as before, because it's not, some things are not done on a logon basis. Google Drive SS is not done on a logon. Sorry. I guess OneDrive is not done on a logon basis. It's done on the, when you start the computer basis. So these are, that's one particular example of a tab that's used. Malware often uses these things. These entries in particular for a logon, and that's why I have it here as an example. Now, what are your strategies? One strategy is to delete obsolete entries, such as file not found. I don't have an example of it here, I'm afraid, but they do show up in a different color. They show up in yellow usually. You can delete or disable programs you don't want running anymore, but you do need to be careful. You have to beware deleting or disabling programs you know nothing about. Programs you want may depend on them. So be careful. Know what you're deleting or disabling. Deleting, you can right-click and delete, as you see here. But you can also unclick them, which means they're still there. They still hang around, but they won't get executed. They won't get started. So these are your right-click options. You can delete it. You can copy it. I think that's probably a copy of the file name. I haven't actually used it. You can jump to the entry, which actually goes into the registry. You can jump to the image, which goes to show the file in its folder. You can submit the virus to VirusTotal, but it's done automatically, at least the way I have it set up, so that it's done automatically anyway. But you can resubmit it in case you think maybe something has changed. You can go to Process Explorer, which basically shows you what's happening with that program while it's running. You can search it online, which searches for the file name. And you can do a find, which I don't know what that is. Properties, you can show the file properties. Oh, search online, is search online for the file. Now, you can and you should look for suspicious entries. For example, virus total as a hit, like that's 1 out of 76. If it's a virus, it probably has more than 1 or 2 or 3. It's more like 40 out of 76 or 76 out of 76 if it's really bad. And you should probably delete that program and that thing right away. The publisher may not be verified. This is Irfan View, I think. And it's Igor Pavlov is the person who signed it, but it's not verified, which means he's not a real official publisher. It's actually freeware. Or it may have no description, like this particular entry here, which is empty. So you need those are things to look for as suspicious entries. So what should you do when you investigate suspicious files? Are there many hits in VirusTotal? You should check the file name online for any virus reports. Is the description good English? Many bad actors, English isn't their native tongue. So beware of bad actors with bad English. And is the file in a temporary folder? Why would a startup file be in a temporary folder? This deserves more looking into. You can also compare against previous checkpoints to see any changes. What you have to do is save a particular, basically group of auto runs, a snapshot of auto runs to a file, and it's called the .arn. Unknown is the name of my computer because I want to be unknown. And so you can save that. And then later on, you can compare the current auto runs versus the previous checkpoints. And then you can see what has changed. Are there things missing? Are there new programs there? It's worthwhile because new programs, you should know what they are. Things that are gone, I wouldn't worry about them. So in a summary, AutoRun is useful to find malware or spyware. It's useful to remove memory or CPU hogs. The source of this is a Microsoft program in the SysJournals package, and this, you'll get more information here. And this is an example of using AutoRuns to remove malware. And it's a good idea to take a look at that, and that may help you remove any problems in your system. Are there any questions?
I don't see anything.
Okay, thanks very much, Tom. So we're at that point, the last 10. It looks like we're at the last 6 or something. So I didn't see any questions in the chat that we haven't dealt with, but now I see one. Jocelyn says, when I start Zoom, and enable chat, it opens as a window. And I don't like that. So I exit from full screen, start the chat, and then re-enable full screen, which puts the chat on the right side. Is there a way to have Zoom and open? Is there a way to have Zoom open up in that setup when it starts?
When I open Zoom, I just get a little window that just says has a variety of choices, and it's one where I want to join a Zoom thing, and that's what I choose. It doesn't open in a full window at all.
Allison has the same issue, and she's wondering the same thing.
We don't seem to have any solutions coming forward. I find Zoom is a little bit strange that way, where it puts windows and so forth. I find it a little bit odd sometimes. I just live with it.
Sometimes they're in the kind of main screen, and then sometimes they break out into a panel all on their own.
Yeah, what I find is if somebody is sharing, or I am sharing, they will come up differently.
Okay, so I guess nobody has a solution to that at the moment anyway, Josh, so we'll have to take it under advisement. So we still have a few minutes. I don't see anything else. Do we want to go backwards, Chris?
What do you mean backwards?
Do this.
Yep, sure. I can handle it. It's just a quick share. So I ran into this a very strange keyboard problem just happened to me. And I went to use my clipboard history by hitting Windows and the V key, and nothing popped up. And I thought, oh, that's kind of weird, but maybe it's just messed up in memory, and, you know, on the next reboot it'll work, or maybe there's a conflict in the keystroke and it's gotten grabbed by something else, and I'll just look at it some other time. It wasn't a panic, so I just used my clipboard, put something new onto it, and carried on. Then, a little bit while later, next, I went to load the settings, and for settings, rather than going clicking on icons and things like that, I always just press Windows and I. I press Windows and I, nothing popped up. I verified that the settings app actually will run by clicking on it through the icons, and it ran. So I thought, that's kind of odd. Next, then I hit the Windows key just by itself. Nothing popped up. And I thought, oh, this is really strange. Everything else on the keyboard seemed to be functioning, but the Windows key wasn't working. I rebooted. The Windows key was still not working. Next. I tried another keyboard, and the Windows key worked on that other keyboard. So it obviously wasn't a conflict with the idea of the scan code for that particular key. It was actually something about that physical keyboard where the Windows key wasn't working. Next. So I guessed it was actually a key failure. So one key on my old keyboard was failing. And so I decided, okay, well, I guess it's time to look for a new keyboard. And I went online looking for that. Next. I hate if I have to change layouts of the keys, and in particular the arrow keys, the home and print screen, the rest of them like that. I like the fact that I've gotten muscle memory on how it's laid out now, and I didn't want to have to go to a different layout. So I was very particular about looking for a keyboard that would match that. Next. And I also, on my current keyboard, I have volume control keys on the keyboard. And I find that really, really handy for muting. On the left, the middle key is volume down and right key is volume up. I find that really handy rather than using the on-screen controls to control the volume on my sound. Next. So I compared pictures of the keyboards online with my keyboard, looking for one with the same layout. And then all of a sudden I noticed, as I was scrutinizing the layout of my keys, that above the function row key, next to where the media controls are, the volume up and mute and that, I noticed that there was a key that was labeled game. Next. And I happen to notice that there is a light over where you have caps lock and num lock and things like that. There was another light there that says game. I hadn't noticed this for like the last 2 years. Next. And I hit the game key, and all of a sudden, the Windows key worked, which actually toggled that off, the game key. Next. So my final analysis, Alan likes to talk about Google University. Well, I went to Microsoft Answer Forum University, and I found it. I actually found it through Google University because one of the first hits was the Microsoft Answers Forum. And the title of this particular post was Windows Key Not Working. I thought, oh, that sounds familiar. And there was an answer from one of the moderators of the forums, and he had 8 different methods to check out how to fix problems with the Windows key not working. And the first method was disable gaming mode on your keyboard. Sounds familiar. And it went on to say some keyboards, as usually marketed as gaming keyboards, have the ability to turn off the Windows key via some switch or function key combination to prevent pressing that key accidentally when you're in the middle of a game that might exit your game or end up getting you killed off in a first-person shooter that you're in with other people. And they had instructions specifically for a whole bunch of keyboards as well as some generic keyboards. And I have the URL in there, and I'll paste that into the chat as well. Next. So the other final analysis, I looked at other potential solutions that were found at Google University, and this I thought was instructional here because one of the hits I found, and this mimicked some of the other 7 solutions at the Microsoft Answers website, changing registry to remove a scan code map is a way of mapping keys to something else. So maybe the Windows key got mapped to something else. Turning off game mode within Windows. Using PowerShell to disable development mode in every app. And I thought, whoa, that's really bizarre. Running system file checker. Yeah, a system file could have gotten corrupted, I suppose. But it never hurts to run that. Running DISM, which is the deployment image servicing and management, to do a cleanup of image and restore health, which does fix some problems within Windows. And it never hurts to run that, but it takes a while to run. Creating a new user account to see if it was something specific to the specific user and checking for malware. So my point on this slide, I guess, is be careful when you go to Google University because it turns out none of those solutions would have fixed my problem. And some of them may have been doing things that I didn't want done, like that scan mode map. Maybe there are other keys that I had mapped that I actually want to retain a different mapping for and things like that. So don't just go to Google University and take the first hit and say, okay, I'll try all of these things. Look at them, understand them before you actually implement them. Make sure you can back out from any changes that you make using anything that somebody advises you to do. Unless they're very, very clear on exactly what is going to happen and any potential negative downsides to the implementation of those fixes. And I'll put in the URL for that one as well in terms of just the sort of things that you can actually come across when you're actually looking for solutions online. So just a caution to be a little bit careful. Turned out that the simplest solution really was just hitting that game key on my keyboard and everything is working again. That's all I have on that.
Thanks, Chris. And you're absolutely correct with Google University. You really got to be careful with a lot of those solutions. I find most of the time they don't work, and I really try and find sources that I know and trust. A lot of the computer magazines, if they have a fix, then that's probably quite reasonable. But some of these other things, they're just bizarre. And a lot of them are trying to sell some kind of program that's going to fix all your worries.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, well, I saw in the chat there was one question about Asus Transformers. We'll leave that till next week. And Lawrence thinks he has a solution to Zoom, which Joss is going to try. So maybe, Jocelyn, you can come back next week with a follow-up and tell us all how to do it. Okay, well, I think we're over the just over the half hour here, so I'll just remind you that December the 14th is going to be TCPIP with Stefan. That's our regular December meeting. If you want to help the food bank, because we don't have an in-person meeting, you can drop off food at Michael Street, or you can donate cash at the Ottawa Food Bank website. And the final thing I have is a reminder for next week, November 30th, will be our next Q&A. So if you do have questions or topics that you would like to share with the group, then send us an email and we'll be happy to sign you up. So thanks to all the presenters tonight. We had a mixed bag, really good stuff. And thanks everybody for attending. See you next week.
Thanks, folks. See you next week.